it's lovely to see so many people here today, but I'm afraid I'm going to leave my thank yous till the end because I'm a notoriously tearful person. And if I get too emotional at the start, it won't be good for anybody. Some months ago, a woman I'd known for many years asked me what exactly it was I did for a living. A sign perhaps that I've generally kept my private work and my private and my work life separate. I can also almost hear my husband snorting at this, as it's his perception that I can't go to a social gathering without signing someone up to write an article, or teach on a course, or in some other way be involved in my working life. I should say, if anyone has any thoughts by the end of this lecture, and they want to submit them to clinical ethics, they'd be very welcome. This aside, separation of private and work space was easy when they were separated by a train journey and work was situated in a far-off and unfamiliar institution. Now I come across students grinning into my shopping trolley in Sainsbury's, and I have taken to going to Waitrose in Lewes. I share my workplace with the people that I live beside and converse with at the school gates. I feel connected to new work colleagues because I discover that we choose to go to the same events in the festival. Two worlds have collided. In common with many in the audience, I feel like I inhabit many worlds and almost the same number of personas, the newest and perhaps strangest of which is Professor of Clinical and Biomedical Ethics here at BSMS. As a member of my family, I'm an older sister, sometimes bossy but hopefully supportive, a partner, proud, adoring, not always focused, and generally of very little use around the house. A mother, besotted, enchanted, and just about capable of making the endless costumes and props required by a 9-year-old girl, but defeated by the technology and language familiar to a 12-year-old boy. It's been a huge adjustment to lose the role of daughter, but a great joy to become an auntie. To my friends, I'm probably the rather scatty one who always struggles to finish the book in time for book group, the one who tries to keep in touch but often fails, but who perhaps unbeknownst to them gains so much by basking in the creativity and achievements of this exceptional bunch of people, enjoying their company in good times and their support when times are hard. I share this slide with you to show what I and some other members of the audience are usually up to on a Tuesday evening. As a colleague, well, that's for some of you to judge, but I hope it's clear to those I've worked with in the past and who I shall work with in the future that being a good colleague is something that I take seriously myself and value in others. In part, what I want to do today is explore what that actually means in practice, not in a generic sense as a member of an exciting new medical school, but more specifically given the work that I do. As the title of my lecture suggests, I believe that there are fascinating and revealing connections between who we are privately and the space we occupy professionally. As a teenage follower of second wave feminism, I completely accepted the idea that the personal was political, and now wonder whether my tendency to see the personal in the professional is a variant on that theme. How is the way in which people manage their professional responsibilities and relationships affected by their personal histories, values and beliefs? And how in turn does the performance of one's professional duties impact upon life outside or beyond the professional realm? Professionally, I am what has come to be known as an ethicist, or as my friend Louise once said, an ethics girl. And this introduces me to yet more worlds. In the weeks surrounding this lecture, I've been immersed in the issues of organ transplantation, end-of-life care, resource allocation, and variant CJD, to name but a few. The danger being that in some ways it feels as if everybody wants a bit of ethics nowadays. And if one answers every call, one ends up being a Jack or Jill of all trades, master of none, at risk of pronouncing on too much and understanding too little. The sociologist Paul Rabanov claims bioethicists do not spend the bulk of their time in laboratories. Rather, they sit on national committees, express their opinions in the press, participate in conferences, etc. bioethics has been assigned the task of thinking about, judging, and proposing regulation for what comes out of the laboratory, not what goes on within it. Consequently, it is consistent that the field has little to offer to possible ethical reinventions of science as a vocation. Rabanoff is suggesting that ethicists are at risk of doing the wrong thing. And were it to be the case that my role was exactly as he describes, I would certainly feel uncomfortable. God forbid I should be seen as a regulator. Admittedly, I spend more time than I ever expected to do in meetings, but I've also had the privilege of access to the laboratory, the hospital, and the communities within which healthcare is provided. In terms of expressing opinions in the press, one must appreciate that the media is sometimes required to work with those most willing rather than those most able to comment on the latest big issue. And as some members of the audience will confirm, the territory we occupy is particularly open to misinterpretation when reduced to the level of soundbites. With apologies to those of you whose job require a willing commentator, I quote one of the participants in our research in defence of my tendency to be cautious. And this is verbatim, so it might not make immediate sense. One of the problems I have when some further ethical debate springs up around the area of stem cells is to try and decide in my own mind if there's something that there's actually of no value, you know. Quite often it's spurious. I think someone gets dragged onto a programme to comment on the latest technological development and comes up with something, perhaps off the top of their head, and you think, well, here we go. Bioethics is certainly publicly recognised as a practical discipline, and ethical punditry is rife. But I and many others hold to the idea that we can neither ignore nor fail to nurture its intellectual roots. If I'm too busy attending meetings or appearing in the media to have time to attend to that myself or to benefit from the works of others, something has gone wrong. Traditionally, the academic roots of my discipline lie in philosophy, which, strictly speaking, makes me unqualified to claim the right sort of background. I originally studied government at the LSE, as you've heard, and although my PhD did focus on consent, which everybody knows to be a central issue in healthcare ethics, my focus was on consent as the basis for political obligation. Fair enough, the Vice-Chancellor has already drawn the links. But in my case, the work involved a close textual analysis of the 17th and 18th century philosophers, Thomas Hobbes and John Locke. In fact, on another occasion, I could probably tell you how much this work has influenced and contributed to my later work. And if it were not in Italian, I could point you to an early publication in which I rather bravely tried to apply Locke's theory of property to the issue of fetal transplantation. But that's to go off the point. Halfway through my PhD, I got fed up with the isolation of being a textual analyst. I found myself conversationally accosting people at bus stops after a long day in the British Library manuscripts room, where one worked in pencil under the watchful eye of an unsmiling librarian. Years later, I found myself doing the same thing in the early days of maternity leave. Draw your own conclusions. My LSE friends were now thriving in the city or doing well in commercial companies and the civil service, and I was tiring of the label student, an early clue perhaps to my unsuitability for ivory tower academia. So I applied for a job teaching political philosophy at Keele University, and to my amazement, I got it. As someone who had never left London for more than a holiday, I faced a number of shocks in arrival in Stoke-on-Trent. But the biggest was possibly the fact that as a member of a small department, I would be required to teach outside my subject area. And in my first term, it would be me teaching the applied ethics course. I have to change the slide here. It's most unfair. That's my rather attractive office at Keele. As if this was not bad enough, I would be doing so in the shadow of senior colleagues who were beginning to make a significant mark on the development of British moral philosophy at the level of theory and metaethics, the branch of philosophy that attempts to understand the very nature of ethical evaluations. My colleagues Jonathan Dancy and David McNaughton, Jonathan's here. I have other photos that I chose not to share. Both of whom are in the US at the moment, were claiming that the way forward in moral theory was to dispense with universal moral principles, whilst at the same time holding on to the claim that there were objective truths to be learnt and right and wrong answers to moral questions. Thus, the absence of universal moral principles was not to lead to a claim of moral relativism. They were pioneers of an approach to ethics called moral particularism. Well, why was this an issue for me? Well, any of you who have encountered the early literature of bioethics or even listened to an ethics presentation at a conference will be well aware of the prominence, particularly in the early days of my discipline, of the approach developed by Tom Beecham and James Childress, sometimes referred to as the Georgetown Mantra. The very title of their seminal work, Principles of Biomedical Ethics, gives a clue to the fact that for them, moral principles were central. Indeed, the very key to moral understanding. And in its most reductionist form, the approach appeared to advocate understanding any moral issue by organising the relevant considerations under their four chosen headings of beneficence, non-maleficence, justice and autonomy. Which way to turn? Should I go with the orthodoxy and help others take Beecham and Childress out to the masses? Or should I accept my colleagues' rejection of their approach and thereby deprive myself of a tool others were finding so marketable, but potentially go on a more exciting and compelling journey? I present these as stark choices, which is to ignore other options open to me at the time and since. I could have aligned myself with the consequentialist approach, which, as I will go on to show, had powerful and effective proponents. I might have been attracted by the resurgence of an interest in virtue ethics. It's possible that I would have felt more readily grounded in some form of deontological account, given my previous work on consent. I suggest that in some ways, the philosophical route I chose to follow was in part at least due to the fact that I found myself in Kiel rather than Manchester or Oxford. Looking back on the decision to eschew principalism, it brought to mind a poem I first came across when my mother studied the poet Robert Frost at a WAEA evening class. And when I reread it, I realised how pertinent the final verse is to my talk today. I'm sure the poem's familiar to many, and I'll only go to the final lines. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less travelled by, and that's made all the difference. Why did I take the road less travelled, and what difference, if any, has it made? Well, in seeking to understand that, I went back in time. At the age of 11, I was asked to write an essay during an English examination in response to the statement, "Like mother, like daughter, like father, like son." I only discovered years later that my English teacher had found it so amusing she sent a photocopy to my parents, which, given some of the things that I had said, now feels like a terrible breach of confidentiality. In this essay, I said that I was far more like my father than my mother. Mainly, it would seem, because my mother was tidy and well-ordered, and I had the insight to realise that I was not. I did give my mother credit for better fashion sense and greater tolerance of high heels than my father, this having been written shortly after a major family incident involving platform shoes. But I made it clear that I would follow neither my mother's career as a nurse nor her devotion to domestic perfection. My father I described as extremely intelligent, but went on to say that I tired easily of his enthusiasm for and interest in my academic pursuits. My school reports bear this out, and now I realise that I shall have to keep these documents away from my children, should I ever wish to lecture them on their attitude to school. Early references to a lack of confidence are replaced within a year by a warning not to become overconfident. There are plentiful references to my lack of attention to detail and, interestingly, facts. There are many complaints about lack of revision, ominous references to my coming under the wrong sorts of influence, and disappointment in the face of my clearly dismissive attitude to subjects I did not value or enjoy. Now I can see how it would have been sensible to try a little bit harder at CSE typing. Yet, by the time that I was 18, I was completely hooked by the subjects I had chosen to pursue at A-level. I did my homework and enjoyed it. I studied for my exams and marvelled at what I'd learnt and, more importantly, understood. Privately, internally, an important part of my identity became the fact that I did enjoy studying. I turned up at university as interested in the intellectual challenges it would provide as the opportunities for fun, freedom and friendship. Indeed, by choosing a London college, I think I sacrificed some of those in the interests of being in the best place. Sometimes over the years, when faced with what appear to be uninterested and unmotivated students, I remind myself of the 18-year-old me, and the fact that I rarely let my tutors know how important my work was to me, and how much I enjoyed learning at that stage of my life. I mentioned earlier that I studied government at the LSE, a little bit after this cartoon was drawn. But at a time when student politics was still very much alive and well, and everyone had a cause to promote and a group to belong to. I originally went to study international relations, having been brought up on a diet of current affairs, news programmes, and heated debate at home. But despite the fact that the subject had been taught at LSE since 1927, by the end of the 70s, its intellectual basis was slim. A saying prevailed amongst the students, "I don't think, therefore I are." I should say that one only needs to look at the Sussex website to see how much things have changed in intervening years, and I will apologise personally to any members from that department. Dreadful as this sounds, I craved something more than was on offer. And at the end of my first year, my wonderful personal tutor, Michael Donnellan, advised me to transfer to the government department, and thereby delve into a discipline with deeper and more sophisticated root system and traditions of thought developed and debated over the course of centuries. Interestingly, I was very happy there, and I was my most happy when tackling the subject I found hardest, notably political philosophy. In the mid-80s, bioethics was in the same position as IR in the late 70s, a discipline in the process of defining itself, and its meta-ethical framework was flimsy, to say the least. It's an exaggeration to say that it was Beecham and Childress or nothing, but it was fast becoming the class textbook. My later-to-be colleague, Jonathan Glover, had written his seminal book, Causing Death and Saving Lives, which I chose to feature on my poster, but his work, whilst logically flawless, was seen by many as opinionated and dangerously challenging. John Harris, now professor at Manchester, was developing his theories on the value of life and trying out ideas as exciting and radical as a survival lottery in the absence of sufficient organs for donation. But again, his conclusions were unacceptable to many, despite his arguments being beautifully crafted and philosophically sound. Beecham and Childress wrote the medical equivalent of the man on the Clapham omnibus, but I couldn't bring myself to climb on board. Moral principles are comforting and provide structure in the frightening world of ethical disagreement and conflict, and the Georgetown mantra does translate very well into PowerPoint. To sell moral particularism requires instead that you convince people that they need to look at the world in a certain way and understand the particularities rather than the possibly non-existent, probably uninformative universals. To use David McNaughton's term, we must seek to develop moral vision. All in all, I had been converted to a way of thinking that meant what is crucially important to moral understanding is seeing and describing the context within which an issue arises, clearly understanding the facts of the matter, and in its most radical form, as propounded by Jonathan Dancy, letting the facts speak to you. I should at this stage also acknowledge that another ex-Keel colleague, Philip Stratton Lake, who's here tonight, has done a great deal to encourage me and others to think about how to place moral intuitions into this picture. These days, we prefer to talk about racing cars and the existence of angels when we meet, but Philip's work remains in my mind as something to which I can refer and think about when seeking to water my roots. I left Keel after 10 very happy and rewarding years. We'd set up 2 successful courses, an MA in medical ethics and another in the ethics of cancer and palliative care, some graduates of which are in the room. And this second course was truly my baby, and I found it very hard to leave behind. Keel has gone from strength to strength since I left and is now one of the leading centres in the country. I hope you don't see a cause and effect there. But in 1996, I joined what was at the time the place to be for bioethicists in this country, the Centre of Medical Law and Ethics at King's. Those of you who've worked at King's will know why I'm not showing any of the buildings there. And I chose instead Waterloo Bridge, which is almost a corridor in King's because it joins the Strand site and the Waterloo site. And it was particularly important to me because I was based with the law school on the Strand site, but most of my collaborators were over with the health sciences and medicine and nursing over the bridge. Here's another rather interesting picture I discovered of King's. I found myself working at King's with another charismatic and influential professor, Professor Ian Kennedy, now familiar as head of the Healthcare Commission. But on this occasion, I found myself unconvinced by my leader's approach on one important issue. In an early conversation, I made reference to my interest in the idea of professional moral autonomy, and Kennedy shot me down. Unsurprisingly, perhaps, as he was the author of the famous 1980 Rees Lectures, Unmasking Medicine, and he felt the time had not yet arrived to worry about the autonomy of a profession, i.e. the medical profession, which had for so long ignored or discounted the autonomy of a group he was far more interested in, their patients. I remained convinced that there was something to look at in considering how the challenges of modern medicine might be experienced by individual healthcare practitioners, and I was further convinced that finding this out would pay some benefit to patients. At the same time, I was becoming increasingly convinced that my natural collaborators looking forward in my career would not necessarily be ethicists. I'd fallen behind in the theory game after leaving Keel, but more importantly, I'd got to the stage where I was more interested in seeing if and how people did ethics in practice. In my job interview at King's, I'd rashly announced that I wanted to work with and research with the people I'd previously been meeting in the classroom, healthcare professionals out in the real world, and that I would find the money to do so. Luckily for me, I did. I got some funding, and my first major project was a European Commission-funded project looking at ethics and communication in European palliative care. Rahana told me off for this URL, so I'll leave it there in the remote possibility that anyone wants to look this project up. It was a fascinating and sometimes frustrating project, and if you did look it up, you'd find that my co-applicants were physicians, epidemiologists, nurses, practitioners, not philosophers. Our hypothesis was that in terms of the ethical issues, European palliative care was not conducive to Europe-wide policy making and directive, despite there being a push for this. But at the same time, the differences in approach between different countries on important issues, such as truth-telling to patients, could not always be explained away and morally justified by reference to cultural difference. We were convinced that there was a moral case to be made for greater openness in terms of diagnosis and prognosis in the context of life-threatening diseases in some parts of Europe. But we wanted to present our case in ways which accommodated and reflected important morally relevant differences between the countries we were studying. We therefore felt that it was important to construct the moral case in each specific context rather than seek to claim that one size would fit all. particularly given the widespread suspicion that palliative medicine was a territory susceptible to British imperialism. We also used the project to investigate the methodological approaches most suited to our ethical inquiry. Our theoretical work was well received, but probably seen by practitioners as interesting rather than directly useful. I have to say we got very little out of a systematic literature review, considering the evidence available for the benefits of truth-telling, but made a surprising and significant discovery as a result of reanalysing epidemiological data on the end-of-life experience of patients in Italy, Ireland and the UK. My suspicions about the costs borne by healthcare professionals and the difficulties they faced in morally contentious fields were borne out by the findings of our focus group work with Spanish palliative care professionals. At least three people in this audience will remember the day that my kitchen became an impromptu recording studio as we recorded the inserts for an educational CD-ROM looking at cross-cultural communication. How I wish I had a photo of that. But most excitingly, this project gave me the opportunity to work with my ex and soon-to-be BSMS colleague, Sue Eckstein, on exploring how the dramatic form might be used to reveal and transmit moral truths more effectively than many other formerly academic modes of communication. And here is a picture of three of the actresses who were involved in the performance of a play that Sue wrote based on the transcripts that had been kept at St. Christopher's Hospice, London, over a 10-year period of the conversations that went on between real people attending the Hospice Day Centre. And here is another of the actresses who may be familiar to those of you who will admit to watching Holby City. But this picture is particularly poignant because when she came to work with us on the play, she was herself in the final stages of treatment for breast cancer. Around this time, I was involved in another project which proved particularly instructive. John Harris, who I've mentioned before, had been asked by Age Concern to convene a committee to look at values and attitudes to ageing as part of a larger millennium project, Debate of the Age. I was there as a fellow ethicist, but the majority of committee members were from relevant stakeholder organisations, and the other academics involved were largely social scientists. At the early meetings, there were lengthy and sometimes circular discussions about how we should use our time and resources. John would propose looking at an interesting conceptual issue. A social science colleague would advocate a survey or a focus group. Finally, one day, John snapped. "Look," he said, "I'm a philosopher. I'm not interested in what people think. I'm interested in what they ought to think." I knew what he meant, but once again I felt slightly out of step. Not only because I was curious as to what people thought, but I'd been married to a psychologist for long enough by then to know that it could have some bearing on what people did, and as an ethicist, I was very interested in understanding that. What's more, when considering the application of ethical concepts and theories, one also needs to pay due regard to what is possible or practicable. And this may sit somewhere between what people tell you they are doing and what the philosophers think that they should be doing. I was fortunate that an opportunity soon arose to take these thoughts further. Over time, I had come to know Priscilla Alderson, now Professor of Childhood Studies at the Institute of Education. Priscilla, and I haven't put her picture up because I knew she'd be cross with me, is a passionate and highly experienced medical sociologist, an academic unafraid to allow the professional to grow out of the personal. Her work has been hugely influential, not least on me, and I was delighted when our paths began to cross more frequently after my move to London. I envied the substantive nature of what Priscilla had achieved in her work, and not for the first time bemoaned my lack of a way in to the world of empirical research. Even though my previous project had delivered the data, I thought that I'd acted as a commissioner rather than a participant in most of it, and that it had only really marked the beginning of a transition. My work with Priscilla was a turning point. At the time, the Wellcome Trust was establishing its biomedical ethics funding stream, and Priscilla asked if I wanted to apply for a grant with her. This we did, and in the process we met and decided to work with Claire Williams, and Claire is somebody I've gone to collaborate with many times since. Wellcome wanted empirical ethics research on one of two topics, neuroscience or genetics. To be honest, neither are of central interest to us, but we felt we could make a respectable go at it and put in for a project to look at how healthcare professionals, whether they felt challenged by the new genetic technologies available within the context of antenatal screening and testing and fetal medicine. At our first meeting to discuss our proposed methodology, we came to the idea that we should do a combination of ethnographic study of the people in their workplace, one-to-one interviews, and then invite the interviewees to discuss the topics that arose as ethically challenging within mixed groups of professionals. These groups were not to be focus groups. They were to be what we came to call ethical seminar groups, because as well as listen, we were going to challenge and question. We would then analyse the data and identify the areas of concern, lack of clarity, disagreement, etc. I remember to this day Claire's attempts to temper Priscilla's enthusiasm and my apparent naivety. "We'll never get people to do all that for us," she said. I genuinely couldn't understand her point. Of course they would. They'd want to do it. In fact, we'd be helping them as much as they'd be helping us. Our experience did, I'm pleased to say, allow me to be at least partly proved right. At the end of the project, our problem was too much data. I think, and I hope, Priscilla and Claire would agree that the really productive exercise had been the groups. People wanted to talk, and they wanted to hear what their colleagues were saying. They also didn't mind being challenged or pushed, although we had an interesting debate amongst ourselves as researchers about how far this should go. To what extent should the groups deliver an account of what people think, and to what extent should they investigate what we might believe they ought to think, or the extent to which they could justify or explain their views. We've spoken many times about the work in this project, and it's difficult to distill down exactly what we found in the time available here. But I can offer perhaps some executive summary points, and I hope you'll agree that this list of publications suggests that people shared an enormous amount with us. We found, first of all, that the people we spoke to weren't yet ready to face the ethical challenges posed by new technologies, as they still felt conflicted about the work they were doing and experiencing as routine and unexceptional. A project that set out to look at the future ended up largely reporting on a screening program that had been running unchallenged for many years. The old chestnuts of academic bioethics were still live and unresolved issues amongst many practitioners. We also found that within apparently cohesive and well-functioning teams, there can, and we came to believe should be, a range of ethical opinion, even on the key issues. As a result of their varying ethical perspectives, we found practitioners adopting significantly different attitudes and roles in relation to the ethically challenging aspects of their work. And in practical terms, we found that this led them to organise their work accordingly. In the course of this and subsequent projects, we have met the midwife who would care for a woman after a termination but would not go to the pharmacy to collect the drug, the scientist who prayed over each embryo before working with and thereby destroying it, the sonographer who detected and reported fetal anomaly but mentally and morally dissociated himself from the process of termination, the paediatrician who eschewed the jobs of obs and gynae and worked instead with the profoundly disabled children who were still born, however much we screen and test. These people all worked together, to a greater or lesser extent, within a system that endorsed, organised and provided services that they found morally problematic. We came to see those operating in morally contested fields of medicine as fitting comfortably under headings which I hope make sense to my philosopher friends. In our experience, we found that there were few, if any, moral absolutists, a significant number of tolerators, and even more facilitators. Hardly anyone denied the moral complexities of their work, and most gave good account of the relationship between what they held personally and what they were asked to do professionally, and how they did their job in the light of that. We also discovered a very interesting issue that arose when healthcare professionals were required to confront the personal lives and personal views of their clients. One of the problems, I quote, that a number of those offering antenatal screening and testing to pregnant women identified was the women who refused the invitation to be screened. This isn't surprising, even given the eternal debates within the teams about the medicalisation of pregnancy and the costs and benefits involved in the process. However, what we and our participants came to recognise together, more explicitly as a result of our discussions, was that different types of refusers were treated in different ways. If a woman presented a quasi-scientific, albeit flawed, argument for her refusal, the professionals would engage in dialogue and attempt to provide her with facts that might get her to reconsider her decision. If, on the other hand, a woman gave a religious or moral reason for her refusal, no further discussion would ensue. This was explained in part by a professional need to be seen as culturally sensitive and religiously tolerant, but it was also presented as something that was beyond the expertise of the professionals, particularly given the overriding professional responsibility in this context to be non-directive. This is not to say that it was the responsibility of the healthcare professionals to change any of these women's minds. Far from it. But it did appear as if some got the opportunity to discuss their choice, whereas others did not. And a claim to equal treatment, to which people held very strongly, did appear to crumble. At the end of this project, and having conducted similar interventions since, I'm convinced that healthcare professionals value the opportunity to reflect and discuss, but that the effects thereof should not be underestimated, and the time and expertise involved in taking ethics into the hospital should not be underestimated. We didn't fly in on a Wednesday morning and confront the weekly team meeting with an interesting ethical issue, discuss it and leave. We interviewed our participants to discover their personal interests and concerns and to build a connection with them as individuals. We created a comfortable and safe environment for them to meet in, and my 20 years of experience teaching in similar settings hopefully helped us out in that. We were able to offer support if needed and respond to individual pleas for further input. These meetings were very difficult to arrange, because in the busy lives of these people, there was very little time for them to concentrate on their own needs as opposed to those of their clients. Relevantly, similar findings have emerged from our subsequent projects. And I list here two projects that Claire and I have gone on to do together, and I'm happy to say that we're just about to start a third. When conducting discussion groups with eminent stem cell scientists, it was striking how much time they wanted to devote to discussing their previous lives involved in animal research, with one participant describing himself as far more exercised by what he'd done to guinea pigs in his earlier career than by his day-to-day working with human embryos. To a certain extent, within applied ethics, one could say this issue was old hat and sorted, but for scientists at the cutting edge, it remained a troublesome and challenging issue, and one on which some of them still sought closure. This isn't to suggest that they were unchallenged by their current work. One discovered, as a result of discussing their use of human embryos, the sophisticated distinctions individual researchers and teams were making between morally acceptable and unacceptable sources of embryos and their cautious attitude to waste. I became increasingly exercised by the media representations of the thoughtful and reflective individuals I encountered. Indeed, in one of our discussions, I remember the shock of the participants when I shared with them the views that philosophers were prepared to allow them. Whilst leading scientists in the field were describing themselves as stem cell refugees from the moral politics of the US, and Hansard was reporting a government minister in the UK referring to the Frankenstein possibilities of stem cell science, we were struck by the inherent moral conservatism of the people we worked with and their overriding concern to proceed with care. Again, should you want to know more, there's the link. Sorry, I haven't left that one up for long enough, because I just want to share with you an interchange that took place in a group between two very experienced scientists. And again, it's verbatim, so not necessarily easy to read. Well, the extent to which we do everything we can, or we genuinely hold back from anything we could do, a lot of the general public think we do everything. I think it's rather the other way around, actually. I think it's the other way around. No, I mean, one of my colleagues teaches at, I think, Blah College, but anyway, liberal arts, and these students said to him, name one thing that you scientists could do, and you don't. There are thousands. Their perception was that whatever they could get away with, they'd do. Interestingly, we found that the sense of urgency and impatience to advance came through far more clearly when we spoke to the clinicians who were waiting by the bedside to apply the results of their scientific colleagues' work. The project also involved us talking to liver transplant teams and diabetic teams. But they and their scientific colleagues acknowledged that as clinicians, they were protected from being perceived as irresponsible or untrustworthy, because their wish to harness the advances was clearly identified with the idea of patient benefit. I could say so much more about these projects, but sadly not on this occasion. But each of them has required participants to bring their private lives into the workplace, to reveal, discuss, and stand challenged on their beliefs and opinions, to allow us to question and thereby lead them to question the way in which what they do in their professional lives is or is not consistent with what they want to be and do ethically. We've sometimes revealed and at other times facilitated the resolution of differences, but we have certainly shown that for those individuals who find a disparity between their personal moral values and the corporate approach, the cost of doing the right thing professionally can be high, and the task of doing one's job at the same time as keeping one's conscience clean can lead to the adoption of surprising distinctions in both language and behaviour. I wouldn't understand any of this had it not been for my social scientific colleagues introducing me with patience and commitment to the joys and challenges of true interdisciplinary working. But I want to now turn to another discipline with which medical ethicists necessarily rub shoulders, and that's the law, and I'll no doubt offend another group of people in this section. Once again, I've been extremely fortunate with the colleagues and friends that I've worked with in this field, and I count as a significant mentor Professor Margot Brazier of Manchester University, who many of you will know from her huge contribution to legal issues in public life. I haven't put a photo up of Margot because the only one in the public domain is so hideously unflattering I felt I'd do her a disservice. Bringing the law and ethics together is a challenge. One of my colleagues once said, "We the lawyers tell the people the standards they shouldn't fall below, and you the philosophers tell them what they should aim to achieve." Of course, it's more complicated than that. As a country, we need laws to govern our behaviour where the safety and welfare of others could be affected by the choices we make. We also see the need to enshrine certain principles and protect particular rights, albeit with an eye to how public morality may or may not fit with this. Two big pieces of work I've done in the legal context have again demonstrated to me the way in which lives are affected by ethical and legal decisions, and the complexities involved in balancing the wish to secure for people the right to live and be treated in ways they consider appropriate when there are other societal interests at stake. On some issues, the relationship between law and morality can become strained, or some might say misaligned, and I found myself involved in two such cases. The first was when I was asked by Mr. Justice Gage in the case of A, B and others versus the Leeds Teaching Hospitals NHS Trust in the matter of the nationwide organ group litigation to provide a report on the ethical issues surrounding the retention of bodily tissues. I haven't advertised my role in this issue since coming to BSMS for fear of being identified too closely with the rather unpopular legislation that followed, but the work entailed in preparing my report was interesting and instructive. On this occasion, the stories I heard were not primarily those of the doctors and pathologists involved. Interestingly, many of them couldn't remember the details. But those of the parents and spouses of people whose organs had been retained after post-mortem without the family's knowledge or consent. The question in ethical terms was whether the families of the people whose organs had been removed and retained without their knowledge had in any sense been wronged and or harmed. This was a question that needed to be considered against the background benefits that could be gained by the practices when properly handled, Alderhay not being such a case, and with regard to the fact that properly informing these people and asking for their consent would have entailed different sorts of harms, but could surely not have been seen as wronging them. At the same time, people were asking whether it was fair to judge the behaviour of doctors operating 30 years ago in terms of the moral and professional standards governing the present day. Without wishing to assign blame, I came to believe that the problem at the heart of this issue was a failure on the part of the medical profession to understand the nature of the act of organ retention as understood by the families. And this in turn resulted from a more widespread failure to share in a meaningful dialogue about what people care about around and after death, specifically in relation to treatment of the body. To use Joel Feinberg's term, they had failed to appreciate what people care about. If the doctors had appreciated the empirical fact that many, if not most, people do care about what happens to the bodies of their loved ones after death, they would have more readily appreciated the moral wrong entailed in not seeking consent to do anything other than that which would have been expected and understood as normal, and in these cases had been assumed to have been the case. Ethicists have an interest in establishing what it is that people care about, but they then need to establish whether in a particular case caring about something or stating that something matters is a good enough reason for demanding that people act in a particular way. The law is a blunt instrument, and in responding to the issues raised by the Bristol and Alderhay debacles, the Human Tissue Act has possibly caused as many problems as it has sought to resolve. However, what has perhaps changed for the better is the greater recognition that healthcare professionals do need to understand what really matters to their clients. I don't know to this day why I was approached to do this piece of work. I suspect it was a junior solicitor doing a Google search, but I do think I know why I got involved in the second role I want to discuss as Specialist Advisor to the House of Lords Special Select Committee considering Lord Joffe's Assisted Dying and Terminal Illness Bill. Professionally, on this occasion, I reaped the benefits of balance, but at the same time experienced its costs. I understand that my name was proposed by people on both sides of the debate relating to assisted dying as someone they could work with, not because I necessarily shared all their views, but because I was able to speak with them and for them as well as against them. However, I cannot help but feel that once I was pulled into the heart of the storm, which was the starkly divided committee that somehow needed to write a joint report on this complex issue, my attempts to retain a sense of balance were sometimes interpreted as lack of authenticity. I had by 2002 been working with palliative care practitioners for a very long time, and had on occasions gone out of my way to challenge some of the ideas presented as the view of one of the only areas of medicine that has referred to itself as a movement. Famously, on one occasion, a leading person in the field lobbied to have me excommunicated for arguing that it was logically, and I state logically, possible to be a good palliative care physician and at the same time agree that some lives got to a stage of no longer being worth living. On another occasion, I had worked with a palliative care consultant to demonstrate just how hard this was to be sure of in practice. I lose count of how many hospices I have visited across the country where busy professionals seek and embrace the opportunity to come together to discuss the many and complex ethical issues associated with their work. But it was rare to be asked explicitly to discuss the possibility or reality of assisted dying. Conversations on this topic tended to take place in the coffee break, by email after the event, or sometimes unexpectedly when someone had the courage to come out as having some sympathy for the idea of people choosing to be assisted to die in the sense meant by Lord Joffe and his supporters. Sadly, there has not to this date been obvious money available to do the sort of research we've carried out with other healthcare professionals, with people who care for the dying. But I am convinced of the need for this. For me, when this debate inevitably re-emerges, we need to be in a position to truly know and understand how the professionals most affected feel about it and would, if required to do so, deal with it. In the face of the almost inevitable media hype that surrounds such an important and polarised debate, I suggest that such work would be valuable and productive, and there is a real need for serious academic attention to these matters. It's surely important to know what people think, not because they've been willing to write letters, or not because they've been organised well by their professional, religious, or other bodies. We need to know what the ordinary people who will be doing the hard work involved think. And what better way to find out than by doing some balanced, dispassionate academic research? So how in the final moments should I sum up the way in which ethics, life and work come together in my life and how hopefully I try to get the balance right? As an ethicist, I feel I have to retain balance in two important respects. First, I need to remember that not everything's my problem. There are areas of life that remain mercifully untouched by ethical considerations. And if one looks to infuse everything with an ethical flavour, one not only becomes difficult to live with, it might also become counterproductive. Ethical oversensitivity can be paralysing for the agent, intrusive for those they relate to. And developing moral vision must surely require being able to tell when there's nothing there to be seen. I also need to remember that people have very different ways of approaching and thinking about and attempting to resolve moral issues, and few have had the luxury of being able to think about this as long and as hard as I have. I was free to follow my own path, but circumstances may have played a big part in the path I followed. My attraction to the difficult over the straightforward, my need to challenge myself in order to stay interested and engaged, the easy way in which I'm seduced by a clever argument and a flash of originality might have set me on the path I have followed. Other people, particularly those for whom doing ethics is a necessary and properly smaller part of what they do, should be free to think about things in different ways. But I will stick to my guns on the point that whichever way they choose to do things, they need to get the facts straight first. In teaching ethics, one has a moral and, I think, professional responsibility to treat the views of all those who provide a valid argument with equal respect, even if one wishes to dismiss or deny their conclusions. Some philosophers, such as John Harris and Jonathan Glover, to whom I've already referred, wear their beliefs on their sleeves and clearly and powerfully advocate the right actions they see dictated by their philosophy. And both of them are gifted and inspirational teachers. It's been my choice not to do this, which probably explains why, when I tried the bones of this lecture out on my husband, he prefaced his supportive comments with the statement, "I usually find your lectures rather dull, but..." And why, at one stage, I acquired the family nickname, On the One Hand. To return to my point about authenticity, I understand that during my time with the Select Committee, there was much speculation as to my position in the debate. And as is often the case, people generally put me on the other side to themselves. Maintaining balance in a field where people feel so passionately at the extremes is not easy, and it carries costs. If I were to be honest, over the years, my desire to be fair-minded and see things clearly from all sides has made it more and more difficult to say where I stand on any of these difficult issues, other than when my prejudices and personal history play out most strongly. But on some occasions, I do feel I know what is right. But on those occasions, I choose very carefully with whom I share those beliefs. But maybe this makes perfect sense. I have tried to make my moral vision more acute, and when it fails, I reach for glasses. The more proficient gaze of a trusted colleague, the writings of someone I consider thoughtful and fair, more facts, more evidence provided by reliable sources. I try to look at the world so that without seeing ethics everywhere, I can recognise it when it's present. I have, through my research, encouraged other people to tell me about their worlds and what they're like in the hope of laying bare the challenges they face and the possible routes through them. As I don't have a bundle of principles with which to show people the way to make that easier, I need to get them to talk to me and to one another and to look carefully at what they do, how they do it, who they do it to or with, so that ultimately it is they who see and understand how the picture fits together and which of all the facts and realities they deal with in their work are the ones that help them to feel happy that they are also free to address the larger question that Aristotle posed to us: how ought I to live my life? However, I know from reflecting on my own life and work that I do how hard it is to achieve clarity, and how in looking for answers, one inevitably throws up more questions. My colleague Catherine Eric, with whom I'm working at the moment, observed the other day that the work we do isn't revolutionary. The facts we uncover are not going to change the world, or necessarily require the world to change dramatically. But that's fine. Returning to an earlier point, perhaps what we do is help the people we work with map the moral change that is feasible and practicable, and as such, our approach owes more to Fabianism than revolutionary socialism. I'll leave you to guess which political society I belonged to at the LSE all those years ago. And now I feel it safe, I think, to say my thank you. I want to thank my lovely family for all the support and interest they have shown in what I've done over the years. I want to thank Jenny Cosham, who's an honorary member of the Farseedus clan, because she's the one that's enabled me to have a work-life balance over all these years. And I want to thank my wonderful friends and colleagues, old and new, who are here tonight. But most of all, although I don't think any of them are here, I want to thank the people who have trusted me with their thoughts and shared in the projects I've referred to tonight. And I leave the last word to my daughter. Thank you.